Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Are you a financial advisor considering the Independent Registered Investment Advisor or RIA model and wondering where to start? Start with Schwab Advisor Services. Schwab has helped thousands evaluate the full range of options and can help you determine your best path forward. Navigate the big and small decisions by tapping into Schwab's decades worth of insights on what fuels RIA success. With Schwab Advisor Services, you have a custodian that will support you every step of the way. Start your journey today at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths.
Hey everybody, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for being so doggone good looking. I appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out to us on the Discord room. We got a link off of the Beekeeping for Newbies. That's newbees.com homepage. Direct link right to the Discord room from there. Also, if you want to learn some more about, we got subjects around oxalic acid, different products that are good starter products, and different types of, Varroa treatment methods and strategies and all this good stuff. So if you go to bestbeekeepinggear.com, we got some information over there as well. All right, everybody, so we're doing episode 151. This is going to be another bee buzz for a variety of reasons. One, I did get some positive feedback that you guys enjoyed the Q&A. I think that's always neat, too, because there's all these things that come up. And as a new beekeeper, you don't know. You don't know what, you know, situations you're going to come up against in the coming weeks and months. And hearing someone else who's also going through the journey at the same time or might even be a year ahead of you, it's like, oh, wow, I didn't even think about that. It's cool to kind of know, you know, the challenges that other people are facing. And sometimes people aren't comfortable asking questions. So it's always great when somebody is to be able to share that. Because I say, you know, like every time somebody asks a question, there's got to be at least 1,000, you know, 5,000 other people out there with the same question. So all good. Now for the updates, the exciting updates. So as many of you have, if you've been following along in the Discord room, you knew about this. I didn't mention it too much openly for everybody and their brother, just for a general, like, family safety kind of thing. But my one daughter last year went out to Wyoming. We had a great trip out there, dropped her off. Well, actually, she dropped me off in Denver, went on to Wyoming, did a forestry internship out there, made a lot of friends, had a great time. It was a really great experience for her. They invited her to come back out again, and we just did the exact same trip. It was within like a week of when we went last year. And I just didn't tell everybody all the details, but it's in the past now, so we can jump into that real quick. So I spent, I think it was like all day Friday, right before this trip. So this is going back like 5 days ago, 6 days ago. I was getting her car ready. We flushed out the old brake fluid, put new air filter in, oil and filter change. And it's weird, man. I'm still like shaky. Like I'm still not right. I'm so tired. But anyway, I'm doing all of that. And she had bought these tires. You know, I looked at her tires and I said, baby, you can't drive across the country in these tires. I said, you've got one of them over here that'll pass inspection. The other one, I don't think so. And I don't know. I think you should get some new tires. We got to figure something out. So she buys these tires and they show up at the house. I spent all day. I've got a manual tire changer in the garage. So I spent like all day taking the old ones off, like getting them new ones mounted, getting them balanced. I do have a little balancer machine that I bought a long time ago. So I got them all balanced up and we're good to go. I'm feeling great about the car. You know, everything is just, it was just great. Everything was exactly the way it should have been. Hotels were all lined up. I had all kinds of like funny jokes planned about how I was going to be messing around with you guys on the way, sending messages to you, be like, hey, I'm down here in whatever, Indiana, what are you up to or whatever. But all of that, all of those dreams and all that fun was shattered because we were about, I think it was somewhere around 7 hours or so. We were right shy of about 500 miles into the trip. And my daughter's driving, so I drove 4 hours and she's 3 hours into her 4 hour shift. And she's looking at the gas tank and she's like, yeah, I'm kind of getting a little low. Wouldn't mind a bathroom stop. I'm like, yeah, why don't you go and take that exit? I see a sign for a Flying J. We can take that exit. And we exit off the interstate. We come down this, slight little hill on the ramp, and there's a light at the end. We stop at the light. Light turns green. We make a left turn. We go under the overpass for the interstate, and we come up to the next light. Light's red. Light turns green. She presses the gas, and just the RPMs go up, and we don't move. And I said, what's wrong? She says, I don't know. It's not going anywhere. I thought maybe one of us just bumped the shifter, bumped it from drive into neutral or something like that. No, that wasn't it. So she messed around, moved the shifter a couple times and finally got it to move forward a little bit. And I said, just try to keep it moving. There's the Flying J right there. It was up on the left-hand side. We had a light coming up where our side was green, but the left turn lane was red, but there was no oncoming traffic. I said, run the light. Just keep this thing moving. So she runs the light. We make the left turn. We start going up the hill towards this Flying J. We're like 3/4 of the way up the hill. There's nobody behind us. And the transmission starts slipping. And I said, okay, try to pull off the side a little bit right here. I reach up. I hit the four ways. I said, put it in park. We swapped. So I'm messing around. I'm trying to get it going, trying to see if I can get something between the combination of changing the gears from, park all the way down through the manual modes. It has a sport mode. I'm trying whatever I can to figure out something to get this thing to engage. We finally get it engaged just enough to get into the parking lot. We pull in, we park. I'm like, whew, all right, we're here. We're safe. Everything's fine. Now, at that point in time, that's normally like when you kind of freak out. You're like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like our car is, pretty much dead in the water. We're 500 miles from home. We're 1,500 miles away from where we're going. I'm like, what? Oh, man. And then I started thinking for whatever reason, like my daughter was really upset. And for whatever reason, I was kind of almost happy. I told her, I was like, do you realize what just happened? I said, we just went almost 500 miles. And of all of the mountains we've been going through, all the bridges we went over, all of the, tight winding and turning and the different, tractor trailers everywhere, of all the miles we just covered, the transmission went out on an off-ramp on a small town, somewhere in Kentucky. And we were 1/4 mile from a place that we could park. We had a little roof over our head. It was like a truck stop. So they had showers. They had food. I mean, it's Flying J food. It's like if you're not familiar with Flying J, it's just like a big truck stop kind of place that has a convenience store. You get sodas and snacks and whatever else. But I mean, we had what we needed to kind of get by long term or whatever if we needed to, wait for a while. We weren't on the side of the road. We didn't have vehicles going past us at 80 miles an hour. I was just ecstatic that we were safe, but I'm so smoked. I'm so exhausted. So I start dialing for dollars, man. I'm calling around. I'm calling, every rental car area or every rental car place in the area. Nobody's got anything. And I'm asking for one-way rental. Hey, can I get a one-way rental from here to Denver? Nope. Nope, nope. So finally, I start shifting things up. I'm like, yeah, I just need a local rental for 3 days. I thought, well, it might be easier to beg for forgiveness later and be like, oh, yeah, sorry, we had to drop this in Denver instead. But nothing. I couldn't get anything the same day for local pickup. Now, back in the day when I used to travel a lot, I had like status with National, guaranteed, less than 24-hour reservation kind of thing. I don't have any status anymore. So we called everybody. We called the airport. There was an airport. I think it was called the Tri-State Airport. That would be like Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia. We called the Tri-State Airport. We called Hertz, National, Enterprise, all these places we called. Nobody's got anything. So I said, okay, let's tow it to, I don't want to give anything away, because if the experience was amazing, I would be on here telling you everything there is about this dealership and why they're so awesome. And like, you got to go see them if you're in the area. Things didn't go great. I went in there and I specifically said, like, look, man, I'm a veteran. I'm on fixed income. Like, I don't have a lot of extra cash. You know, can you help me out? This is our situation with this car. And I don't feel like I was exactly helped out. And that's about the extent of what I'm going to say, because it makes me want to blow a gasket. But we ended up buying a car, basically. We bought a used car, which is so terrible, of the same make and model, just 5 years newer. But it was literally like, that's all we could get. There was just not any decent selection on the lot. I had to get something that was going to get us out there and keep my daughter safe while I get on a plane to come back home. It was just not a cool situation across the board. And I really would like to air it out, but I'm not going to do that. Man, I feel like that's a little unprofessional. And it doesn't get us anywhere. If I sit here and tell you all these bad things about some company, like, it's just not going to help anything. So anyway, we buy this car, we lose 8 hours, but we're like, you know what? We're going to push through and we're going to try and stay on track. So we pushed it through all of Kentucky, rolled through Indiana. We got into all the way through Illinois to O'Fallon, Illinois, stayed at a hotel there, slept in a little bit longer than we had originally planned, but that makes sense. Got up the next day. If you're not familiar with the place, we went for like a brunch around midday. It's a very high-end establishment, very prominent throughout the South, the Midwest. They're pretty much everywhere in the U.S., called Cracker Barrel. So we rolled into the old Cracker Barrel for like a little brunch, and that was good. Got back on the road and drove until 9 p.m. local time in Aurora, Colorado. And I got to tell you something. If you like a good salmon, you got to swing by the old Applebee's. So I know you're going to laugh and you'll be like, Jeff, are you serious? Applebee's. I haven't been to Applebee's in probably like, 15 years. I haven't been there in forever. And like last year, the last time my daughter and I were coming back, I think we were on the return trip, there was an Applebee's. And I was like, you like Applebee's? And she's like, oh, they got this really good salmon. I was like, oh, okay. We go in there. I had this salmon and it was really good. So we roll into Aurora, Colorado. I told her, I'm like, I'm getting that salmon. So we went in there. We got some pretzel bites, salmon, broccoli, little garlic mashed potatoes. And I think I had a little house salad. And I don't know if it was because we hadn't eaten like great food in a while. We were just exhausted. I have no idea. But I felt like it was like one of the best meals I ever had in my life. So if you're ever in Aurora, Colorado, I know there's three. I think there are three Applebee's in the area there, but it's the one right across the street from the Black Bear Diner. Great food over there. Very impressive. So that's my life, guys. Congratulations. You get to be a part of it with me. All right. So then my daughter takes me to the airport. I'm thinking the drama is over. Oh, no, no. We can't be quite that lucky. So I'm on the plane. Everything's fine. And the pilot gets on. And he's like, hey, yeah, we got a little bit of a communication error with our grounds crew, so they're just going to swap out and get a different headset, but we'll be getting on the way here shortly. Okay, fine. A few minutes go by. Hey, everybody, yeah, the tow bar, we can't seem to get that disconnected from the front wheel, so we just need a few more minutes to get that taken care of. And then the next message is, yeah, this little cloud thing that came over here has a little bit of lightning with it, so we got to wait another 15 minutes for the lightning to go away. Eventually, we make it. We fly into Detroit. I have flown in and out of Detroit exactly 2.6 million times. I know the airport well. I know the area well. I get there, and as soon as I get my phone back on, it just goes nuts with all the messages and alerts. So my, like, 9 o'clock flight or whatever it was is now 12:30 a.m. I'm like, you know what? Don't care. Whatever. I go to the gate that's on my electronic boarding pass. By the time I get there, nothing's going on. I refresh it. It's sending me to a different gate. This would be the McNamara terminal, for those of you who are familiar with the airport. So I go from like A, I come in on A, I go over to C. It sends me then back to A, then I go back to B. So I literally am walking all over the place because it keeps changing. I get to B, the B terminal, and they're like, yeah, your flight is now delayed. And I'm looking down at my phone, and it said till 8:40, and I'm like, 8:40? Like, it's already like 9:30. And I'm like, oh, 8:40 tomorrow morning. That's not delayed. Like, 11 hours is not a delay. That's actually a cancellation. But anyway, we were delayed 11 hours. So I go and I talk to Stephanie. So if you know anybody there at Delta in Detroit, young lady named Stephanie, very nice young lady. I said, Stephanie, do you by any chance have anything going to like Richmond or somewhere relatively close by to where I was trying to head? And she's like, yeah, we got one leaving into Richmond in about a half hour. So I took that, got to Richmond, hour and a half drive home, rolled in about 2:30 this morning, and that's where I am. So things are looking up because I'm home and we're all alive and we're safe and healthy and happy and all that kind of good stuff. Talked to the transmission shop local to me. Good guys. I've worked with them before. For them to rebuild the transmission is going to be $4,500, which is about half of what the dealership was estimating. If they said if it's a failed transmission, it's going to be around $9,500, something like that. So that's that. Looks like we are going to be rebuilding a transmission and getting the car back to my daughter and then trying to dump off the other one somehow. And that's the end of that. So that's been my excitement and my drama this week. I'm exhausted. I'm completely smoked, which is why I'm not going to put together like a full episode that requires a lot of kind of thought and making sure that things are done really, really well. We'll just, it's a lot quicker and easier to continue running through. I think in that list of questions I had last time, we had 37. I think we made it through 11. And I've already rambled like 15 minutes already on my backstory here. So we'll try to do the best we can to rein that in and get into some of the questions and hopefully have a little bit of fun.
Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Save big money and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of Bonnie plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all 4.5-inch Bonnie plants are on sale through May 18th. Head to the Menards Garden Center to get your garden growing and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
So number one on my list is one that was, I think we actually addressed this before, but it was in a separate section of notes. I'm not 100% sure, so we're going to go ahead and cover it again anyway. It's still relevant to the time of year, and it won't hurt to revisit this. Are weekly inspections really necessary? And they also added, I prefer them, but it's really tough, so maybe bi-weekly? I would say about 75 to 80% of the time, you can get away with doing inspections every other week. But when we look at the development cycle of a queen bee, it's 16 days. So the colony will typically swarm before the new queen is going to emerge. So the queen cell should be capped around day 8. So if you did an inspection on Saturday, and then that day they decided to start raising a new queen, by the time you come back 2 weeks later, the colony may have already swarmed. If you see a fully capped queen cell, swarming is pretty well imminent. And on a 2-week schedule, especially during the spring, you are likely to lose some bees. And if you're questioning that, if you're like, oh, I don't know, Jeff, I think you're exaggerating, I don't think it's that bad, jump into the Discord room. I think there are at least 20 people in there who lately have said, like, yeah, I did an inspection, everything looked good. I came back 2 weeks later and they're gone. We've had one gal I've exchanged some messages with. I think that she had a colony of swarm like three times. They're just, it's kind of crazy. So you do need to stay on top of that. I really recommend once a week. And I could say if you have the idle time, have a little bit of downtime, you can go in there every 4 or 5 days if you wanted to. There's nothing wrong with tightening that up and making it a little more frequent if you want to spend more time with them. I think really like maybe every now and then you can squeeze like every other day or a third day. You just don't want to be in there all the time because they do want to have some peace and quiet to get things done. And I think the more that you're in there, if you get in there too often, you're going to start creating some undue stress for them. And, that's never a good thing. Okay, so this next question here I have is, what's the difference between reversing boxes and adding a new one? So when we say reversing boxes, this would be for a configuration where you would be doing, it doesn't matter if it's an 8 or a 10 frame setup, it's still a Langstroth hive, but it would be a double deep configuration. So what tends to happen is when bees have an empty cavity, they're going to obviously start at the top. They've got to hang the comb from somewhere. So they're going to start at the top and they're going to work their way down, building the comb. Once everything is completely built out within the cavity, they go through this, it's a pretty consistent way of doing things where your honey is going to be, up near the top and it'll be above and to the left and right. And then all of the brood and the food resources that they're using to raise them, like your open, your pollen, and your bee bread and all these things will be down a little bit lower because those are things that are immediately being used to help, rear new brood. So you'll see this cycle where they'll be up at the top. They'll work their way up as they are consuming resources over the winter, and then they'll work their way back down as they're laying new brood, and then work their way back up as they're storing honey and everything away, and then they overwinter and they consume the resources in a general upward direction. So there's a lot of this kind of back and forth. You don't have to do anything. You can completely leave it alone, and I promise you that they will figure it out. Now, what I do like to do, though, a lot of times I've seen where my bees are raising all brood in the bottom, in my bottom deep. The upper deep is completely packed with honey. Then I get to the period of the year where it's a dearth, and I'll have completely empty, basically deep, down at the bottom, and then I'll have a deep that's completely full of honey, and then a honey super on top of that that's packed out. Sometimes I will go ahead and pull that deep, or I'll even move a honey frame or two up so that I don't have to have that deep in there at all, and I'll just leave the honey supers in, and then before the fall flow kicks in, I'll add some space for them again to continue raising brood back in the regular brood space. But again, that's something you don't even really need to worry about it. I say early on, just leave it alone. What you're trying to avoid is excess space that they may have to defend. So if you do get into like a dearth period and you've got this large area of open comb that was being used for brood, not really being used as much right now because they're not raising brood, it doesn't hurt having a big open space with plenty of airflow moving through. When you get into the cooler time of year when they aren't raising brood in there, that's where I say, hey, it's not a bad idea to go ahead and pull that empty, unused second deep out. But a lot of times what people will do is as the bees are the cluster is working its way up in the wintertime, they'll go ahead and just take the top deep, reverse it so that they're already in now the new bottom deep, right? Because they've reversed them and they can just start working their way back up again. Either way, whether you rotate them or not, they're still going to raise new brood. It's just a matter of where they start and how they get to where they're finishing things up. You can always reorder things later. So like, let's say that spring rolls around and you find out there's 2 frames of brood up top and then they move down to the bottom and there's 4 frames of brood at the bottom. You can always go to the top, take the 2 out of the top, put them down into the lower deep and just move a few frames at a time. So if you like to do that and it makes you happy, you certainly can. I don't know of any real tangible benefit like, oh my gosh, you have to reverse these because it saves all this time and it's so much more efficient. Bees do like to have the brood and everything down at the bottom. And they do like it to be relatively close to that lower entrance. So that all makes sense. But they will figure it out on their own. They don't necessarily need your intervention on that one. Should I be rotating frames in the spring? And if so, how? My general recommendation on frame management is once you stick your finger, like if you take your fingers and you kind of push in on a piece of the comb and it's brittle, it should be like if you push your thumb into a few cells, you just look at an area of 4 or 5 cells, If you push your thumb into that and that area doesn't kind of collapse, you probably need to go ahead and replace that frame. Now, you can just scrape off the comb, put it into a wax melter, do something else with it, repurpose it in some way, as long as it's a healthy colony. You can repurpose that for, melting down to paint onto plastic foundation and plastic frames. But when it starts to get really solid and it's not really pliable anymore, that's when I usually do that. And it tends to be like around a 3 to 5 year type of cycle. I definitely recommend doing that periodically. It's just a good practice because that is kind of a history of the health of the colony. And all things good and bad are going to be contained within that comb. It doesn't hurt every now and then to just kind of start off fresh. What are the signs that my bees are running out of room? So this one's pretty easy. The bees are going to try and swarm. Now, the primary area that's going to be driving that swarming behavior is in the brood box. So when there's less brood pheromone, and I know we talk about this a lot, but when there's less brood pheromone, there's a lot of forager pheromone, that imbalance is definitely going to trigger some swarming activity. So when you look into the brood space, where let's say that you have a standard deep and there's a lot of brood rearing taking place across, let's say, the middle 6 or 7 frames, when you look into that space and you are starting to see a whole lot of pollen being stored in there, particularly honey that you get to where we call being honey bound, they will start storing a lot of nectar inside the areas that are normally being used to raise brood and for the queen to lay eggs. If you start seeing a lot of brood space being filled with nectar, that is another really good indicator. It doesn't hurt at all. I always say, when in doubt, super. Or I've also said sometimes, super early, super often, right? As soon as you think that they may be running out of space, they probably already have. So go ahead and add it on a little bit early if you're not sure. And you can always remove it if for some reason you were wrong. It's a lot easier to just remove an extra super than it is to wish you had one on there and next thing you know, some swarm activity is kicking in. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a little bit of a pause here and go off to a discussion that we've kind of had recently in the Discord room. There's been a whole lot of talk lately around swarming and what's going on with the queen cells and when to do what and supersedure versus swarm and cell location. These have all been very prominent discussions lately. I'm not going to go really, really deep with this, but I just want to say, don't get too wrapped up around, is it this type of cell or that type of cell? There are different things to do with different cells, but what I want you to pay attention to more is the queen herself. So where is the queen? What is her status? And when I say what is her status, you can't tell why, if she were being superseded, unless you see a visible injury to her, you're not going to know why she's being superseded. If you have a queen that is laying well and she's got a beautiful brood pattern, everything looks good, she's a new queen, you just got her this year. If you're seeing cells and you're thinking, oh, this is in the middle of the frame, this must be a supersedure cell. This is one of the most common misconceptions. Yes, it is very normal for a supersedure cell to be, one or two of them and generally in the middle. But remember, it's not always the middle of the frame. It would be like the middle of the hive. So if you have two deeps and a honey super, like the lower half could be the very top of the bottom deep's frames. So you have a bottom deep, the top deep, honey super. The bottom deep at the very top of that, you might see a swarm cell right up there. And you wouldn't say, oh, well, it's above the top half, this must be supersedure. No, it's still a swarm cell, and there's 20 of them there. So that's the other thing, too. Like, supersedure, they don't make excessive numbers of cells typically when it's a supersedure. If you look in, you see 7, 8, 10, 20, swarm cells or cells of an unknown type, that's a swarm cell. But either way, you have to look at, what am I going to do in any situation? If I have a colony that I know was queenless, or I deliberately made it queenless, then I want those cells. I want them to develop. I want that queen to emerge, to become mated, and to take over in that role. If I have a queen and everything is going great, I don't want to get a new queen, unless there's a problem. If I have a queen, but she hasn't been laying well, she's been acting funny, like you look at her and she's visibly not moving very well and clearly looks like something's wrong with her, yeah, it might be time to let them go ahead and let nature take its course. But like I mentioned earlier, the real urgency kicks in once the cell is capped. So if you see a queen and you're looking at her and there's plenty of eggs and larvae and everything looks good, and you also have cells, it's safe to destroy those cells when they're still closed. Again, it's once they close, that's when things become much more urgent. But from your perspective as the beekeeper, the real key to differentiate is, what's my queen status and why would there be a cell? If you don't know why the cell is there, like you have no idea, you're like, oh my gosh, what is this doing here? Chances are really good it's just a swarm cell. You did a walkaway split last week and you see a cell, you should be expecting that cell because they're making a new queen from an emergency cell. I hope that helps a little bit, because a lot of times people get wrapped up around, is it this type or that type and what do I do? There's really only two actions. Am I keeping the cells or am I destroying them? And what is my end goal? Where am I trying to get? Now, to solve this, one of the recommendations I made, and there's a lot of different ways of doing this. This is just one thing I do and I have done, and it's effective for me. If you find something else that's better for you, by all means, please share it with the rest of the group. But what I like to do is do what I call a synthetic swarm. And this would be taking 3 or 4 frames. Hopefully the queen is on one of them, or you can manually remove her and take her out, however you want to do it. But 3 or 4 frames with the queen into a nuc off to the side somewhere else, and then go ahead and remove all the queen cells. Leave that colony alone, preferably with no open brood at all. Leave them alone for a couple of days. Usually just 2 or 3 days is enough. Just let them settle down. Make sure there's no other activity. There's no other queen cells. You've had a chance to go back and double check a second time. You still don't see any queen cells. And then you can merge them all back together again. Now, like I've told you many times, I don't involve myself with the newspaper method. If that's something that you feel that it gives you a warm and fuzzy, makes you feel good, great. I've never done it in the history of my beekeeping journey. I've never had bees fighting about anything when I joined them together. The only scenarios where I can see it being an issue is when you said, I'm going to go ahead and put this colony and this colony, I'm going to jam them together, and they're 2 strong colonies. There probably is going to be a fight of some sort. But it's not like every bee on each side of the colony, you know, colony A and colony B, they're having a big battle royal in the middle of the hive. They are going to choose a queen. Like, they're going to essentially say, it's either going to be a scenario where the 2 queens are actually going to fight, or the colony is going to say, I like her scent better, and they're going to remove the other one. So I don't worry about that at all. Now, there are scenarios where, like, if you're dealing with a laying worker, it can be a little bit more tumultuous, challenging. It can be a bit, I'm so tired. I'm so exhausted. It can be a bit more challenging if you're dealing with a laying worker, and we can certainly talk more about that later. But I hope that helps add a little bit of clarity to things. Okay, when should I add honey supers for the first time? If you want to, you know, I don't want to say that. I was going to say, if you want to, you can go ahead and add honey supers when you do your first inspection. But a lot of first inspections are happening on a couple of nice days at the end of the winter. So you maybe don't want to go quite that early. What I'd like to do is be able to give you just a certain, like, rule. Just say, whenever you see this, just do this and you'll be fine. The reality is, when they're coming out of the winter, they should have plenty of space. There should be a ton of room. But they are going to fill it up fast as they are ramping up that new spring, you know, the new spring population. And there are tons of foragers now out there bringing in all these great new resources. Things are going to fill up quickly. What I would say is, when you get to a point where you are seeing, like, on that first inspection or maybe the second or third, when you see you now have a lot of brood, the number, the population is really starting to increase, and you're starting to see a bit more contention for space that is available, at honey super. The only thing you would need to worry about is, let's say you have an end of winter colony. They're already kind of depleted. They're using the last of their resources to try and rear this new brood that's going to take over and run with things for the spring. And as they're trying to protect that brood, you get some really, really cold nights. You need to have plenty of workers to keep the brood warm. And that is a very, very vulnerable time. I think I've shown pictures in the past of colonies that have had 4 or 5 frames of brood ready to explode, and they freeze out because it got too cold and there weren't enough workers to keep them warm. Once you're getting to the point where you see you have enough workers in place to actually maintain and protect the brood that you have, it's no problem to throw a honey super on. When your nighttime temps are like pretty much, and I'm going to go with Fahrenheit here. I can probably get pretty close on Celsius, but I would say, you know, when your nighttime temps are probably like around 5 or 6 Celsius and maybe like 38 to 40 or better, you know, maybe 40 Fahrenheit or above, that's warm enough to where they may still, of course, you need to cluster to stay warm, but they're not really, really cold. And they're going to have a decent number of bees to where they can still provide the coverage that they need to maintain that brood. So you really have to use some discretion with that. But I would say once your temps start to get above that kind of 40, 42 degrees overnight, you throw an extra super on. The amount that what it really comes down to is you don't want them to have to heat a big empty space. And by this time of year, it just doesn't usually get that cold. Like by the time of year where the bees are really active every day and you're thinking, should I be supering or not? Even if it did get like really cold for the night, they aren't going to use a ton of resources to stay warm for the night. So I don't worry about that little bit of extra space being a really big issue. Now, if you said, hey, I'm going to add 4 honey supers at once, I'd be like, hey, you know, that's probably not necessary, but putting one on is fine. And once things really get ramped up, go ahead and throw 2 on at a time. Some people have been like, Jeff, 2 at a time, that's just crazy talk. I've seen them knock that out in about a week before. You get a big, strong colony really exploding in the spring, and they will fill those things up super, super fast. Is it okay to install a new package or nuke into Drawn Comb from last year? Absolutely, and I strongly encourage it. If you already have Drawn Comb, now, so, you know, nucleus colonies are already going to have that. Nucleus colonies should come pretty well packed out. I think one of my favorite mentor statements that I heard this year was, nucleus colonies won't swarm. That's a fun little thing that we had to encounter in that discussion this year. But nucleus colonies will absolutely swarm. But they're going to come with completely drawn out combs. That's not really an issue. But where it would be an issue is, let's say you've got a 5-frame nuke, you got a 10-frame Langstroth. You have 5-frame spaces still available. Do I use the old comb from last year? If you are taking this from a colony that is a healthy colony, everything is fine, they just either didn't make it, or maybe it is surplus comb you've been storing or whatever, nothing wrong with reusing it. You just want to make sure you know the source, and kind of when you're in doubt in your own bee yard, like, well, where did this one come from? Just do a visual inspection. Does everything look okay? Does it smell? Is there any kind of a strange smell associated with it? Ideally, if it was a problematic frame from previously, you would have destroyed it and gotten rid of it a long time ago. Anyway, you wouldn't have it laying around. But do the standard 72 hours in the freezer. That's always a good, you know, that doesn't solve all problems, but it certainly is helpful. So I strongly encourage the use of those, particularly for package bees, because that way they can go in there, they can kind of polish up those cells, and that queen can start laying almost immediately. So it will really, really accelerate the development of those new package bees. Can I mix old frames with new foundation in my boxes? Absolutely. You can do that. Just follow some of those rules we talked about earlier as it relates to cycling out, you know, frames and foundation every couple of years. When should I put out my swarm traps or bait hives? In my area, the swarms will start to kick in, particularly down in the rural areas where the apiary is. The swarms will start showing up there in like mid to late March. And they'll run all the way through like early June. I think I caught a swarm down there last year or first week of June. So I would say put them out if you're in the mid-Atlantic area, kind of where I am, maybe mid-March. If you are in the south, anywhere in the south, I would say probably maybe like Virginia, Tennessee, North Carolina, anything kind of south of that area, you're probably good like 1 March. The key important thing is just make sure you go back and check them periodically. Make sure nothing is trying to move in and live in them. Make sure you're refreshing whatever swarm bait you're using, if it's Swarm Commander or some lemongrass oil or whatever bait that you're using. Just be sure to go through periodically and, you know, refresh that. I would say you're probably going to want to be on maybe like an every other week or at the most maybe 3 weeks before you refresh those. But if you're buying a commercial product, you know, obviously follow the instructions that the manufacturer provides. But like every, you know, every 10 to 14 days, you know, refresh that a little bit for your bait. How do I split a hive in the spring, and is it okay for a first-year beekeeper? So I'm going to go in reverse order when I answer that one. I do not recommend at all for not a first-year beekeeper per se, but a first-year colony. A first-year colony needs time to ramp up. Let them get big. Let them get strong. You're going to be far better off yourself, and the bees will be far better served to attempt to go into the winter as 1 strong colony versus 2 weak colonies. So my recommendation is if you can do it, please keep them into a single colony for the first year. How do I do it? Well, we can do a whole episode, I think we already have probably multiple times, about how you split. There are one-to-many splits where I take one really big hive and I make it into three or four. You can do several colonies into one where you're basically taking, let's say you have five colonies that you have already, and you pull one frame from each of them into a nucleus colony, and that becomes a split there. We can, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, how you get your queen beyond that, but that's just one way of how you're getting all the resources for it. And then you can also do like a 50-50 where you just take half of one and now you have two colonies. And of course there's the walk away approach, right? We've talked about kind of the big downside to that is this, you know, 40-day period where you're not getting any new replacement honeybees, which can be bad. I like to have at least a queen cell, but preferably a mated queen lined up when I do those 50-50 splits. But if you do that, I recommend leaning a little bit heavier on the colony that does not have a queen. So instead of 50-50, you might want to be like a 35-65 or a 40-60 in favor of more bees going to the colony that doesn't have the queen, because they're going to need resources for longer, whereas the other colony is going to continue laying eggs and raising more brood. What does a good brood pattern look like? Essentially, what you're going to see is the queen should start around the middle and start laying in kind of like concentric circles that are, or concentric really like ovals, I guess, not... If it becomes an oval, I guess it's not really concentric, but she's going to kind of lay in like an ovular pattern that is in the same rough shape as the frame itself. So I guess if you had a square frame, it might be more of a circle, but you'll see this oval that's going to gradually get bigger and bigger, starting from the middle and working its way outward. And then always on the edges of that for about anywhere between 1 and maybe 3 inches, you should start to see resources in that space. You might have a couple of empty cell rows, like 3 or 4 rows of empty cells. Then you'll see a little bit of pollen in there and a little bit of nectar mixed in. And the further you get towards the upper left and right corners, that's where you'll see either nectar or even some capped honey, depending on the state, you know, and exactly where it is in its drying process. And then generally like your lower parts, you know, lower left, lower right, that whole bottom area, that's where you'll see more of your drone brood. But what you should see is a nice oval with the oval continuing to expand outward. And then as the bees will emerge, you'll see them emerging in order that they were laid. So the middle center of that oval, they'll start to emerge from there and work their way out. And then, of course, the queen eventually will come back and backfill that space. Now, what you can also notice, too, some people get really scared, upset, concerned about this. Your colony's hygienic behavior, it comes down to, you know, how well do they manage everything? This can be from, let's say, for example, you have bees that can smell or sense or detect varroa mites inside of a capped developing pupa. They can actually open up the cell, reach in there, yank out the pupa, throw it out, get rid of it. It's an infected, you know, developing worker, and they'll throw it out. So you may see spaces where, for whatever reason, that developing worker did not finish the development. Something is wrong with it biologically, or it could be sick, ill, something else is wrong. So you'll see periodically where they are removing certain cells. The removal of some of them is perfectly normal in a good hygienic hive. When you're starting to see a lot of that is when it's a problem, because that is usually indicative of a more widespread illness or disease of some sort that needs to be addressed. So having, you know, one out of every 15 or 20 is probably about as low as I would go, right? You want to see maybe on an entire frame in the whole capped brood area, maybe like 5 or 6, right? I'm just kind of making it off the top of my head, but you don't want to see a whole lot. If you do, you probably have some bigger problems. Okay, this is going to be the last one here. I can't believe how many we still have left, but I did ramble for a lot at the beginning with my exciting story here. I see a few queen cells. Should I be worried? I think we kind of covered the queen cell one, so we're going to go one more. There's a lot of drone brood. Is that normal at this time of year? It is very normal to see a lot of drone brood on what I would call the periphery, typically like the lower left, lower right of your frames. If you have double deeps or at least more than one deep or medium or whatever it might be, it's not uncommon at all to see some of that drone brood. Let's say you had 3 mediums. If there's a lot of brood within the second, you know, the middle medium, it wouldn't be unusual at all to see a lot of drone brood near like the top of that bottom medium. But they will always kind of try to push them off to the sides. That's pretty normal. And having a lot of it in the early spring is very normal as well, because we're getting a lot of those new virgin queens are getting ready to start emerging, and they're going to need mates. But remember, they're not mating with your drones, and even most likely, they're probably not even mating with drones in your apiary, because the queens are typically flying a little further away than the drones will, which I think we've already talked about that, but we can certainly revisit that. Well, everybody, we made it up to number 22. We're going to be doing 22 through 37, I think I have on the list, plus whatever else comes up between here and there. I'm probably just going to keep running with this format because the volume of questions right now is really, really high, and I want to answer them for everybody. I will. We are tied up this weekend. My middle daughter is graduating this week. We'll be attending her graduation this weekend, and that's should be the last of the big things we have going on until her wedding this summer. But it's just a really hectic time across the board, as all of you can tell. But I will be recording again. I'm not going to be able to record on this coming Monday, but I will record on Tuesday and get that out. And then we'll do the last of all of these updates, hopefully, by the end of next week. So we have today's episode. We'll have another one Tuesday. We'll do another one next Thursday. So we'll have three of them within a week period here. And hopefully we'll be caught back up. And I think that that's pretty much everything I've got. So if you go to bestbeekeepinggear.com, we've got a lot of write-ups in there about, again, with Varroa mites, some introductory beekeeping concepts. We got a lot of these articles are sourced over at Pinterest. If you check us out over there at Pinterest, we've got, I think, 22, 23 different articles that are kind of linked off of there. Beekeepingfornewbies.com. It's newbees.com. All the information for the Discord room is in there. The nuke plans, swarm trap plans, all that cool stuff. All right, everybody, I've got to go get to work. We got more to do, and it's so good to be back here with you guys, though. I missed you guys. I wanted to be messaging people while I was on the road and joking around with you, and we kind of got smacked down a little early, and I'm a little exhausted, but it's good to be back here in the home studio and chatting with all of you. So take care, be kind to one another. Remember that I love you. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.